music.
Blog Talk Radio.
Oh, good, there isn't. Hello, everyone, and welcome to Book Discussion. I'm Fran Lewis, and I am so excited because it's not snowing and it's not raining. The sun is shining. It's cold, but it's beautiful outside. So I hope you're having a nice day wherever you are, and I hope the weather is beautiful, and I hope everybody's ready for Thanksgiving next week. At least some of us are ready to take a break. And I have a great show planned today. We have the former FBI agent Mark Bouton, and he's going to be talking about his book, The Sacrifice. And we also have the author of The War Zone and APO 123, John Henry Brebia, and he'll be here next. And I want to send my good wishes and prayers out to Darren Frey. Darren couldn't make the show today. He has to take care of a medical issue, and we all wish him the best and hope that he can come on the show. And I want to say hello to some everybody else. I want to say hello to Ken. Hi, Ken.
Hi, how are you, Fran?
I'm here, and Sandra's here. Hi, Sandra. And
hi, Fran.
Hi, and Mark Bouton, welcome. Hi, how you doing?
Hey, fine, Fran, thank you.
Oh, I'm so glad that you made it. I'm so glad that we were able to do this. And Mark's book is kind of scary. The Sacrifice, and as I was telling him before we got on, yeah, the ending sort of got me nervous here, and when it's a Mark Bouton book, you just never know what the ending's going to be. So would you tell everybody a little bit about The Sacrifice, and I know that Ken handles the chat room, and I know if Ken has any questions, he'll just let me know he wants to ask something. I know that, because you read this, right?
I know, yes,
Ken,
I did read it.
Oh, good. So if you have any questions... Yeah, of course. Oh, good. I loved it. It was one of those that I read it in a day books, not even. Okay, so Mark, tell everybody about the book, a little summary and about the main characters.
Okay, the quick and dirty summary is that the FBI races to find a kidnapped baby before she meets an unthinkable fate. And it's an FBI thriller, is what I term it as, and it has to do with the main characters are a male and a female FBI agent who are stationed in San Antonio, Texas, and there's a kidnapping of a baby from the hospital, and that becomes a big priority case for them to solve as soon as possible, of course. And there are all kinds of little extras in the book about it's a state senator's baby, and there's sort of political influence, and then the press is of course interested in it. And the other things are there's some all kinds of interconnections in the book that you don't see in the beginning, but it's sort of like one of those jigsaw puzzles where you see little pieces, but they don't make any sense until you start finding some that go together. And I have a satanic cult type connection in there, and different people who are involved with that impinge on the whole plot itself.
Yeah, he actually told you very little people.
Good.
He's reminding me of somebody else that's not going to tell you too much about the plot. We're going to skirt around this today. Okay, so when you created the first scene, the kidnapping scene, how did you make it seem, how did you create it so that no one would really know that it really happened? It was just so flawless that nobody even realized that it was going to happen.
Well, I'd say basically I sort of studied hospital routines and policies and looked into the type of security that most hospitals have. And of course, I had to figure out some way to sort of circumvent that so that it would be a successful kidnapping. That this sort of thing does happen because
yeah.
I think in the last 6 weeks there have been two or three cases that were very similar to this, where a woman got in the hospital and just walked out with the baby. So that shows it's kind of torn from the headlines.
It's scary because don't they have ID tags or something? And I was reading,
yeah.
I don't want to tell you.
Yeah,
there was one book that I read. I'm not sure if it was in this one. It sounds like 1,000 books, where it actually explains how you can deprogram a tag that somebody is wearing, that a child is wearing. That there is a way that they can do it. That you described it, didn't you? And how the person came out.
I described some possibilities, and then there are other connections inside the hospital that affect what happened, and so that's sort of the plot, you know, toward the end. So can't give that away, but
we can't tell anybody anything because that would really kill it. Yeah, I know.
Well, I want to tell some things.
Well, what are some of the reasons? This is, you know, this is sort of related to the plot. Okay, was a senator's child, right? And what would be some of the reasons why someone would actually kidnap a newborn baby, besides the fact that some women have a child and lose it, and then they figure, well, they're going to take someone else's, or in their minds they think it's theirs. So what would be the rationale that they would do something like that?
There are some psychological situations. As you say, someone has lost a child, or maybe... maybe it's been an accident, or maybe they've had a miscarriage, and to them, psychologically, they think they should have a baby, so they will take someone else's. Could be to sell the child. It could be because they can't conceive one, and they want one so desperately they will take someone else's. It's called a neurotic personality disorder, kidnapping, when it falls within those categories. And this, as you know, we see cases of it every couple of weeks, it seems like, on the news. So it happens.
So there's a lot of black market, in other words. They would sell it to the child for a lot of money to an adoption agency or to parents.
There are so many people who are paying large sums of money for babies now. It becomes like anything else. If there's a market, the crooks and the thieves will get in on it some way.
Even an adoption agency, from what I understand, my friend adopted my nephew, I should say, years ago, but it's still a ton of money, and there's a ton of red tape too. How well do they investigate the parents that are trying to go for an adoption? I mean, is there a way that they skirt around it, or do they actually look to see that these people are not criminals?
Well, I think the state adoption agencies do a pretty thorough background check on people now. As far as if you have an attorney who sort of specializes in that, I would say probably less so. It's more of a business matter to them.
So I have a question. When the officers, the police in this particular book, or any kidnapping, how do you begin this type of investigation? And how does searching for a newborn differ from searching for an older child?
Well, the big thing would be, of course, an older child is going to have activity patterns that they follow. They're going to have friends. They're going to have people in the neighborhood who know them. And people at school and that sort of thing. So you can track witnesses better that way. Whereas with a baby, it has no history. It's just come into the world and now it's gone. And so it makes it more difficult, but you have to start where it happened. Say in my book, it was the hospital, and so you interview everyone who was in the hospital at that time to see if they saw anything that looked out of the ordinary or suspicious or whatever. And anybody who was in the parking lot coming to work or leaving work, and all the employees and the people who come in as patients during that time. Other mothers and fathers. This was in a maternity ward type situation. And, the women that come in, mostly women that come in and help out in the hospital, volunteers, might be in there at the time as they were in my book. So there are a lot of people to check out.
That's an awful lot of people to check out, and an awful lot of people that could just walk out. I mean, have they ever had an incident where somebody's actually, you know, hidden the baby in one of these backpack things or pouches, or it looks like they actually, you know, are the mother of the child and did just walk out with it? We wouldn't even suspect it.
I'm thinking that one of those fairly recently was along those lines. I'm thinking that that's the way they did it.
That's scary. That's my diabolical mind coming. Go ahead, Ken.
I was asking you, Fran, are you going to start coming up with plots and ways to steal babies?
I'm going to come up with plots. You know, it's funny because sometimes some of the authors say to me, you know, I would say, well, why don't you write this, or are you going to write that? And I'm coming, you know, I come up with these things out of nowhere. Of course, can I write it as well as you guys can? Probably not. But I can think of different ways to write things. I've given some other people ideas. That doesn't mean they're going to use them and say that she came up with the brilliance. But, yeah, no, I can steal the baby, but definitely figure out how you can.
I'm
not worried about my doing it.
Not trying to suggest it that should be done. Actually, there's at least 90% of the stranger abduction cases that are solved, and most of them within a week. So it's, you know, even when it does happen, it's a big priority
pretty much
for
get
law enforcement. Yeah.
Yeah, it just bothers me when a mother of a child, the real mother of a child, leaves the hospital and then leaves the child like they did a few weeks ago on the beach in a bag, and the baby dies.
Oh.
That kills me. That kills me because, I mean, there are cameras and everything, but there are ways that these professional people can make sure that the cameras don't find them, or they wear a mask, or they can't. There's no identifying anything. That's what's scary. I mean, how many cameras are in a hospital where they can actually see what's going on? And aren't there baby monitors or something in the nurseries?
Yeah, you know, it depends on the hospital, how much they can afford to budget for that sort of thing. But you can go from fairly simple means to very sophisticated ones. And as you say, monitors in the nursery itself, and the baby and the child having to be together sometimes before they can even go out the door, and things like that. Security bracelets, and then
the security
alarm
bracelet
from the doors. Yeah, and then you should have a sophisticated videotaping system in the whole hospital, but some do and some don't, of course.
Of course they don't, and then some of them just like figure out a way to skirt around that particular thing. That's scary. I mean, even for parents that might be listening, when you have even a nanny, I mean, you should have a nanny camera hidden where they don't know it's there, so that you could actually watch what's going on if your child acts kind of strange when you come home.
I think that's an excellent idea, right?
Yeah, you have,
actually,
you have to be careful.
Yeah, in my book, you know, I'm putting the baby in jeopardy here, but the actual theme of my book is that we really need to, as parents and as neighbors and whatever, we need to really take better care of children.
Yeah.
As they're being brought up than we do now. And I'm kind of showing the ways that children can be affected by adult behavior throughout the book. And that's sort of the reason I wrote it.
Yeah, that was one of the questions I just crossed out. Yeah, because, it was so easy for the person to just get out of the hospital and nobody even knew it. And then I'm not going to tell anybody on the air how you described how they, you know, desensitized or deprogrammed the bracelet because we don't want anybody getting ideas out there. But
right.
It sounds like a viable way that somebody could actually do it. I think that's why when my niece gave birth 2 years ago, and she'll probably do the same thing again in February, why she made sure the baby was in the room with her all the time and not in the nursery. I think
yep.
a lot of parents are going to start doing that because if security is compromised, you have to be careful. So who are Atherton, Jenkins, and Jester?
They're characters in the book. They're all FBI agents. The Atherton is a big guy, sort of the action type, and he enjoys making arrests and doing the stakeouts and that sort of thing. And the more physical type situations you'll run into in police work. And Jenkins is a supervisor. He takes care of the watching over the cases that a number of agents are working on his squad. And he also sort of coordinates an investigation like this to make sure that some people are covering these leads and some others covering different leads and coordinate all that. And Jester is sort of the opposite of Atherton. He's a black man who is slender and very, very bright. And he is also quick with a quip, so you're sort of a sidekick to Atherton instead of the Chester like the old Matt Dillon days. They call him Jester because he's funny. So, but he runs into a situation with a new baby of his that's endangered because of being born prematurely, and that affects his role in the case.
Yeah, that is, you know, when a premature child, I know my niece was, I was too, but hey, listen, you just never know.
Yeah, exactly.
What is, who is Gloria? I don't want, give away too much, but yeah, we have to figure out who these people are. Who is Gloria?
Yeah.
And who
okay.
is Ransom? I'm crossing out this one because we don't want to tell these two people. Who is Gloria? And who is this senator whose child was taken?
Okay, the senator is Baldassar is his name, and he grew up sort of poor, but he married a rich Anglo woman in Texas, South Texas, and her family supported him as run politically, and he became a state senator and is a pretty powerful figure in the state. He has a law degree and he has contacts in the government. It was his baby that was kidnapped, so he's sort of putting on pressure on the agents to solve it as quickly as possible. And let's see, Gloria, you asked me, is the main character is Jack Ransom, FBI agent, and he.
Mm-hmm.
is separated from his wife, and they had a marital problem that he separated, and he's got two children, and he's trying to keep in touch with them and still live separately, and he's dating, and the Gloria is the woman that he's dating at that time. She's Hispanic and a stewardess, and good-looking and, rather energetic and all that.
He's divorced and he has children, right? So how come he's so busy with his cases that he doesn't really have time for them, does he?
Well, yeah, it's partly because you spend so much time working as an agent, and partly because, like all parents, he has other interests that he would like to devote time to, and we find bringing up kids that it's really difficult to do that because they take so much of your time. And they're just sort of a pull and tug there between those situations that I think most everybody faces.
So that is, you would understand that, of all things. That must make it hard. So when you're working for the FBI, it does affect your personal life, right?
Oh yes, you have to have an understanding family.
I know from every book I've read about anything related to the FBI or true stories or whatever, you really do have to have an understanding family to
right.
understand that you put yourself in danger all the time. But you're still do you do consulting work? Do you still do consulting for the?
You know, I don't do that per se. I do give lectures to law enforcement groups and civic groups and library groups. Mainly right now, I wrote a book called How to Spot Lies Like the FBI.
That's what I just wrote on my paper.
Yeah, most of the time I will talk about that because I have a PowerPoint topic that goes with it, and I get to discuss some of the cases I worked with, you know, where I detected someone lying and it helped lead to the case being solved, including
the
Oklahoma City bombing.
Are you going to use that in one of your books? Because my brother-in-law still didn't give me back the book. He's got it. He just refuses to return. He borrowed it, and that was it. That was the end. Now I have to go get another one because this is a really good book that you wrote, and I learned a lot. Just trying to write something myself to detect a lie, but. Are you going to use that book, or do you use what you wrote in it when you write these cases or when you write a novel?
I'm actually using my protagonist noticing things that people do that are in my book, either body language or facial expressions or different verbal clues or tells that indicate they're lying. And actually a lot of mystery writers that bought my lying books, so they can use that to show that their guy can tell when someone's lying.
Well, I'm going to have to get another copy because my next book, My Faces 3, actually has a title, and it's going to deal with lying. That's all.
Oh, okay. Uh-huh.
And so I'm going to have to get another one.
It's amazing how many of our books and movies are based on lying. I realized as I was researching this, it's maybe 90% of them, it seems like.
Yeah, people actually tell it so straight, but you can sort of tell. I mean, if somebody is too pat and their eyes don't move or whatever, and they just don't look straight at you, you know they're lying. But I can sort of tell anyway. I learned a lot. I did. Like I said, dealing with Medicare, Medicaid, and all those agencies, I could even tell over the phone when they were trying to get one over on me. It didn't help. So
right.
Tell us about a little bit about the Exalted Shepherd. And why do they investigate them?
Well, that's when we have Jack Ransom has a informant who calls him and who is affiliated with a cult there in San Antonio, and he's starting to tell him things that are going on that are pretty very strange and very dangerous possible situation coming up. And the Exalted Shepherd is the head of the whole group. There are probably 100 cult members that go to these meetings, but they are starting to talk about a sacrifice, and it sort of builds up. They do things like animal sacrifices and put body parts in the cauldron and stirred up with sticks and all this sort of stuff to gain power. But now as it develops along the book, it becomes they're going to make a human sacrifice. So that gets to be a big deal at that time. And then later it's going to be a baby sacrifice. So now they've really got to check it out, and they wonder if there's any connection with the kidnapped baby in it. You have, let's say, a lot of pieces going this way and that way, and you have to put them together to figure out what's going on.
Ken, you have a question?
Well, yeah, I was wondering about the FBI's involvement in this case, and, you know, especially given recent headlines and things. You know, do you think would it have been any baby who was kidnapped, or is it because this is a politically significant family?
My experience has been any baby is really important to the agency. Any child, actually, but especially a baby, because of the reasons that you probably need to devote more manpower to covering all these different leads. There's going to be problems because of political influence and more press covering the thing, and sometimes that's not such a good thing if mm-hmm. they're at the wrong place at the wrong time or whatever. And it can get to be a sort of a confusing mess at times, but I don't think there would be any real priority just because it was a quote important person's baby, because we've had I've worked on baby kidnapping cases before, and I mean it's just all out with as many people as we can get there and whatever resources we have to try to settle it, you know, and get the baby back in good health. So
that's interesting. But in other words, if it was just anybody, it wouldn't matter? Or do they sometimes work harder because it's more pressure from a senator?
No, I don't think the pressure from the senator would have a big effect.
That's good.
Yeah. At least that's my feeling. It wouldn't on me.
Why when they depict it on television, it does, though, for some reason. They give you the impression because it's the president or a senator or somebody that's very, very wealthy, then all of a sudden. So why does this senator seem so cold? He has no personality. He's really not somebody that you like. I didn't like him.
Of course, he's in a strange, pressurized situation with his baby being missing, and he's used to having power to get things done, and now he has to let someone else handle it, and he keeps trying to think of ways that they should be handling it. So it's frustrating for him and frustrating for the FBI and the other people involved in trying to find the baby, too. So that's part of it. He's just... He's under pressure himself, personally, that he's put on himself, you know.
So could you explain, for people that don't know, there are different kinds of cults, right? This particular one is, what would your definition of a cult be, and what kind of cult was this thing that we're talking about, without giving away too much?
Well, it's a Palo Mayombe cult, and it comes from, or is most prolific, I think, in Mexico. And there have been, I worked in Brownsville, Texas, which is right on the border with Mexico, and there were a couple of cases when I was there about, I think there's a college student kidnapped by a cult like that and killed. And then there's a DEA agent who was kidnapped by a cartel, but there was some connection also with a cult with them, and so it's something that does happen, and I did a lot of research on different cults, and I sort of maybe combined some things from different ones just to make it a little more dramatic. But,
It was.
I wanted to make it realistic, you know, it's hard to research these things because you go in the libraries and the bookstores, and the favorite type of book for someone to steal is something on satanic cults. They'll all tell you that.
Oh, my God. Maybe you need to write one, you know, just on your own. Then they can, at least they would be stealing something that you wrote, and it wouldn't matter.
I think I learned all I need to know or want to know about that sort of thing.
Well, don't they have a lot of that on the net? I mean, I found that when I was looking, you know, for certain things for my other book, or helping to write an essay for my nephew for whatever, you can find almost anything, can't you, on the net?
Yeah, that's true. Yeah.
And the information on the net, which would be more current? I mean, you're getting a book that from the library that might be last year's or whatever, and yet you're on the net, somebody might have written an article maybe this morning on it or something like that. So which information do you find is better?
Well, as you say, you know, you could probably find more current articles and things on the internet. A lot of the satanic things seem to stay fairly stable over the years. Some of the ceremonies have been going on for a couple hundred years or more. You know, a lot of these dark magic type practices have been in certain cultures for forever. You know, as long as they've had the culture, voodoo or Santeria or whatever like that, they've just been part of the culture for hundreds of years.
Well, that's not the only kind of cults. There are other kind of cults, but this particular book has satanic cults.
Right.
Would you ever write about in another novel? Would you ever choose another one, or a different kind of cult, especially the ones where they brainwash people to give them money and give over their give everything over there?
I've considered that, but I haven't really thought of a plot that would be complex enough to sustain a novel on that. Although I think someone who has some good inside information on that could do a good job. I know there's a woman writer in Arizona, that Betty Webb, who writes about the polygamous cults, and
that's interesting.
A good job on those, yeah.
Well, those have been on the news, right, Ken?
Yeah,
those have been on the news.
Well, Betty's out here, and she's quite good. And
yes,
one of the things that's fascinating about the polygamous cults is, of course, they're not stealing children or anything like that. They are not looking to add people. The fascinating thing that leads to some great stuff on Betty's part is they're constantly pushing kids out. And what happens is you have these kids, the boys, and, you know, they got to get rid of them because they want the girls to marry.
Right.
So they literally are trying to get rid of the boys. And so you have this stream, and it's quite real, actually. You have a stream of young boys. They hit adolescence, and they're kind of pushed out of the communities and dumped here in Phoenix and stuff. And, Betty has done some really very intense books about that.
Yes, she's very good.
That is scary. Maybe you guys ought to team up and write one together. That would be interesting.
Yeah.
Well, Ken could write something like that too. I know that. On the other hand, I don't know. it's an interesting topic. So, what would be in the mind of somebody that would be the leader of one of these cults? What would be their rationale for wanting to have one with human sacrifice or anything? I mean, there are other cults that I've read, Heartache and Sin by Charles Soto, which was really, really good, about one of these cults where they actually brainwash people to live in this place and give over all their money in order for this guy to get rich. And they believe that they were doing something good.
That's sort of a familiar thing. That's and that's what David Koresh was doing in Waco. Was the men would have to, or the families would have to turn over all their wealth to him, and then he was also the only one who could have relations with the women, and then he was marrying these girls who were 11 and 12 years old and all that sort of stuff. So that was got to be a bad situation.
Yeah, that I know. I've read quite a few books like that, and you get the reaction that you get when you're reading it, and then you're trying to really, you know, showcase it so people really know that's horrible. So what happens when they go into, do the police or the FBI, are they allowed to go into these places or cults and arrest these people, or are they allowed to just do what they're doing because they own the property and it's private?
Well, of course, it's hard to get enough information for an arrest warrant or a search warrant unless you can get someone who was in there and will tell you all about what's going on and be able to get enough information. Now, that's what Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms was doing when they tried to raid the Waco because they had information about guns in there and all these different illegal activities. But they were not expecting them to be quite as much of a military force themselves when they did that. So
and they can't you can't just go in there. You're not allowed to.
Well, yeah, not without a search. I mean, you can't even go into someone's house without a search warrant anymore, even if you think they did something criminal, unless you really have some evidence of it and can prove it to a judge enough to get a warrant.
And that's not so
easy. That's one of the reasons, by the way, that a lot of crime writers prefer using private eyes and newspapers, because they don't have it, because then you don't have to worry about all this legality. I think that it is much harder to be a law enforcement, especially before the Patriot Act. Now I think they get away with a little bit more, but because they can kind of twist people's arm with that kind of hidden threat. But, you know, the reason people join the half these cults, you know, and I think you kind of passed by a little bit. Yes, they want the money, and yes, that's important to them, but much less important than the money is the sexual dominance. Cults are really mostly about sex and sexual dominance.
Yeah, I think there's a little bit of the type of divine feeling, you know, that they are better than everyone else, too. These leaders are sort of deluded with their own power. And I actually interviewed Marshall Applewhite, who was the leader the Heaven's Gate cult that was the largest mass suicide in the U.S. Out in California. And this was before he had established the cult, and he was talking about wanting to get people, you know, to follow him. And this thing with the spaceship was coming to pick them all up. And, but, you know, he hadn't done anything at that point, so there's nothing he could do, and he was quite an unusual fellow, to say the least. And somehow he got, you know, at one time, I think he had a couple hundred people following him, and then I think there were like 35 or maybe more that committed suicide to his say-so, but the spaceship was coming.
What is in the mindset of somebody that would actually fall for this? I mean, just how weak are they? You're right. These people think that they are superior. They're
dominant.
What's in the mindset of somebody that would even join one of these cults? Why would they do that?
I think they're probably not in the mainstream of culture and society. And it's, you know, like these hate groups, maybe skinheads or the Nazi, neo-Nazis or whatever like that. It's just a group to belong to, and they may have never had a group that paid any attention to them before. So it just is something to belong to, and it's like gangs. I write about the gangs in L.A. And a lot of things there, it's just a matter of survival and in your neighborhood, because if you don't join, then they're going to beat on you or kill you or whatever. So it's just a matter of being safety in numbers and a little collegiality in numbers and saying that you belong to something.
So in other words, could it be something also for people that are alone, people that alone is and just want to be
accepted?
Absolutely,
yeah. I think a lot of the loner types are the ones that join those things.
Well, except that then you have like the Hare Krishnas, and
yeah.
you have the and you have the, an enormous number of very successful people
yeah.
got involved with
yeah.
good old Jim Jones. I think there's something.
Sure.
There's something. I think there is something that we as humans are attracted to. And it is, I think it is the belonging, it is the feeling that we're doing something that somehow is important. And, of course, the whether we call it, you know, I mean, whether we call it Islam or Christianity or Hasidic Judaism or, we, you know, all those nice religious things, or we call it a cult because it's not in the mainstream, it's always that we in the group have some kind of arcane knowledge, some kind of understanding of the world that nobody else has. And doesn't that make us real special?
I think
or
that's an excellent point, Ken. Yeah, that's right. It's a very good, very well made. Uh-huh. There's just degrees of what the different groups amount to and what they believe in and, you know, maybe how many people believe in that sort of thing. And then if you get down to fewer people and their beliefs seem a little strange to the majority, then maybe they are cults instead of real organizations.
Mm-hmm. We're all the same.
But, the sociability and the wanting to be part of a society of some sort or another, I think, are a big part of it. And then, yeah, I can see that point about wanting to feel like you're doing something or accomplishing something or part of a bigger plan or whatever could have some draw to it also.
Well, some of these...
Sex and drugs are sort of a satanic cult draw, too. So.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
And then what happens when they want to not be in the cult? Is then that becomes a problem in some particular
yeah.
cases, doesn't it?
A lot of times it does, yeah. They are not wanting anyone to leave because, well, once again, that could be a witness against them.
Yeah.
And, they don't want that somebody going to the authorities and describing what's going on.
Well, some of these people that are in these cults, because I wouldn't know from around, but you just don't, the fear factor too, right? If they, once they join these and they're supposedly, you know, doing what they're happy, they're accepted, whatever they're given to do, the fear of telling anybody or the fear of not living up to the leader's expectations or the fear of leaving it, that sense of fear, isn't there a lot of that in there? I mean, some people just accept it and blindside it blindly, but others don't they, once they get there?
Yeah, I'm sure there are ones who after a while say this is not for me, and then a lot of those organizations like that will have enforcers who either make sure you don't leave or make sure you're incapable of talking.
That's what I'm saying.
I think there could be some of that in some of the groups.
That's what's really scary is that, you know, some of these people are just so apt that they want to be part of something or feel that they're doing something that they don't even think, they don't even look in to see what it is that they're joining half of the time, do they? They just automatically
friends of theirs, are in it, and they go to see what it's like, and so on and so forth, get drawn in for some reason or another.
That's scary. So, Ken, you were saying that these kids that get thrown out, because they're boys or whatever, and
yeah.
they
you
don't
mean
want
in,
them
in
that.
In the polygamy sex, yeah.
Yes, in the polygamy section. So what happens to them? Do they join a different cult, or they wind up in jail or group homes? What happens to them?
Well, an awful lot of them end up making their way in the worst ways possible on the streets. They end up, you know, being sexual, you know, basically prostituting themselves. There really is. I mean, there are groups and there are people, especially people who have, a lot of people who have gotten out of the polygamous groups and gotten themselves set up here in Phoenix. I'm in Phoenix, in case people are wondering. But places like this, they're trying to help. I mean, thankfully, there are people trying to help.
That is scary that they don't want boys there. You would figure that because they're all not related, that they would want the girls to have the boys there in order to have more children, to have more girls.
Oh, no.
The
inbreeding is incredibly small because you start with like maybe 10 families that are run by patriarchs. And they are switching off their daughters, yeah. And then, you know, a very small number of the men continue. You know, my son is gonna stay. Okay, so now we marry him off. But we're talking about very horribly incestuous kind of thing, too.
That's scary.
Yeah, I think a lot of the men are in their 50s and 60s, aren't they, Ken?
The patriarchs are all quite old, and again, it's very scary stuff.
What happens if one of these girls in any one of these cults says no, and she doesn't want to be part of this? Can she be allowed to not do it, or do they, you know, punish her or whatever?
I would say that if she absolutely tries to run away, of course, what they do is they then, you know, send her off, and she's equally behind, and she finds herself on the streets.
She might be better off.
and some of the families that are trying to help are those women who are, and the worst thing is that very often when they leave, they have already, and you know, they're having children very young because they're having these soul marriages, you know, they're like 14, 15 years old. So they have a baby, they can't take the baby with them. They're not able to do that. So what do they do? They have to leave the child. I mean, it's just horrific. And as you mentioned before, Betty does a lot of writing about this, but I'm not sure that people really, I think a lot of the time when people read this stuff, they think this is interesting fiction. Well, it isn't.
These young people that do leave don't have an education or a trade or anything either to make their way very well.
This is also true. This is also true. That's a very serious problem. We also have a similar problem with a rather large, significant number of Amish youngsters even though they are nowhere near as cultish and manipulative toward strange ends as some of these other groups, the whole idea of an Amish community is to keep people within a form of living or a form of thinking that stops them from, you know, that limits education. And so these kids, I know that they have, like on TV now, they have the show Breaking Amish or whatever it is. And there is a certain truth to it. The kids are allowed to go, a lot of them, on this Rumspringer. Well, not all Amish groups offer that, but they do go out. Some do. But they go out in the world and they say, okay, I wanna stay here in the English world, as they call it. But then what? What do they know how to do? They know how to put up a barn. They know how to drive a team of horses. They know how to use a scythe to mow a field of wheat or a field of hay. I mean, these are not very high-paying skills.
It's the afternoon barn raising and the evening
They don't let them go to school out of their area. Don't they? Some of them go to colleges and stuff like that to see if they really want to become something else.
No, very, very few. A very small number evidently do allow some kind of additional education. But typically it is an eighth grade, and the only reason it goes up to eighth grade is because that is the state law, like in Pennsylvania. You know, so the kids go. But even there, the school they're going to is their own local school. And the teachers are their own local teachers. Maybe occasionally one of the teachers will be somebody from, you know, from outside. But a lot of them are people who are, they technically have college educations, but not much of an education, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, I do understand that. Considering I'm an educator by trade, people, I do understand that. And obviously, I get the impression, because I've watched that program, Breaking Amish. I've watched it.
Mm-hmm.
I get the impression that if there's milking to do or barn or something that on the farm wherever they work, I guess that takes precedence over school too.
Of course, it wouldn't on any farm.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. Whatever they're doing takes precedence over it. I know I did. I watched it. I've watched it a couple of times. It's very, very interesting, to be very honest. It's interesting to know how they live. I'm surprised that these kids don't rebel more at times. I mean, and yeah, then there's so much that they don't know that's out there, too. So, Mark, when you published this novel, before I introduce our next guest in about 5 minutes, when you write this, do you have to pass it through channels to the FBI in order to get it approved before you can write it, before it can be published?
Yes, I actually have to do that, send it in, and they will read the whole thing to see if there's anything, confidential information or sensitive investigative techniques, anything like that, compartmentalized information that was given away, and they give their okay, and they did okay this book. And I just want to mention also that this is my fifth novel, and I have a new publisher. It's Oak Tree Press, and they're in Illinois, and they have done a
really
fine job for me, and The Sacrifice and How to Spot Lies Like the FBI are both available at Oak Tree Books or Amazon, and they're both out in Kindle, too. So,
well, tell them about the other ones, too, that I read, your L.A. gang books, too.
Right, those I have Cracks in the Rainbow and The Second Savior. Yeah, thank you. And they're a little more gritty and action-packed type books, I would say.
Yeah, they are good, and I'm wondering
if
you're going to bring my
characters
back.
Although there is a lot of action in The Sacrifice, so yeah, it's sort of close to them.
So tell me, when is your next book coming out? When do you think it's coming out?
Well, I'm trying to finish writing it, so once I get that done and go back and rewrite the parts that need it, then I will find a publisher for it, hopefully. And it takes a while. It So hopefully within the next year it should be coming out.
Well, that's good because I hope I get it before it comes out, like I did this one.
Oh,
and
all
Ken
right.
Is gonna want, and I know Ken's going to want it also. And Ken and I are very good at writing back covers, both of us, too. I can tell you
oh,
that.
Oh, okay.
So that's an offer. We're doing a show right. Before you go on December 18th, if you're available. It's on December 18th at 4. I don't know how many people are going to be on it, tons of people. And we're just going to talk about, if you can, I will put you down. It's at 4. It's for 2 hours, or who knows how long. And we're going to talk about just mystery writing and putting that extra twist in something or whatever we come up with, or how you market your book as a mystery writer. And we're going to have a guest author, and I'm not going to tell anybody who it is. This is a best-selling author, but he's new. He's new to this also. So which really makes it great. So I want to thank you so much for doing this.
Well, I've enjoyed it very much, and I look forward to the December 18th program, too.
Yes, I'm going to put you down for that. We've got on that December 18th program, I should tell everybody, I'm not going to tell you who the guest is, but we've got CJ West that just asked to be on it, David Workman, I think, Karen Vaughn, who's always a trip, and of course Ken is going to be on it, and our very special Delaney Oakes, who's coming out with a new book. She's going to be on it, and John Betcher and Karina Goretz. So that should be interesting, people, and my mystery guest. Yeah, it's going to be
sounds
fun.
Great.
So I will email you with all the particulars as soon as I figure out what they are. And thank you so much, Mark.
Well,
and
thank you, Fran and Ken. You guys have a good day then.
Thanks. Now I'm going to introduce our second guest, and I hope I say his last name right. If I don't, just correct me because I'm not sure. He's the author of my book of the week from last week, The War Zone. It's one of my favorite books. It's going to be one of my picks for the month. And just so everybody knows, on December 1st, I'm going to start picking my 50 books for the year that I love, my 50 best. So, John, hi, how are you?
I'm fine, thank you very much. And the name is pronounced Brebbia, B-R-E-B-B-I-A, as you know.
Brebbia, I just wanted to make sure. I didn't want to say it wrong.
Well, you have to watch those Italian names. You know what I mean?
I figured. So can you tell everybody a little about yourself? Because you have an interesting history.
Yes. In a nutshell, I after serving in the Army JAG Corps, for 3 years. I came home to Brookline, Massachusetts, and then journeyed down to Washington, D.C. to become a trial lawyer at the Federal Trade Commission. And from there, I went to work for a law firm, one of those white shoe corporate law firms, the Washington office of a major Atlanta law firm, and I spent 16 years as a partner in that firm, practicing corporate law successfully, I might say. And I was also on the board of a bank during that time in Las Vegas, and I was asked to come out to be president of the bank holding company, and so I journeyed west. One of the motivations in leaving a high-powered law practice and coming to Las Vegas was to have time for activities such as writing a book. I had been working on my first novel, APO 123, for several years in Washington, but, you know, working 7 days a week and 7 nights and raising a family left a little time to really devote to writing. So at any rate, I got to Las Vegas, joined with a couple of other published authors in a writer's club called Lefty Salazar and Associates. And that I did in my spare time while I was in the banking business. I left the banking business, became an entrepreneur, and returned to private practice. Anyway, kept on writing. And finally, after 30-plus years, I got to publish my first novel, APO 123, with CreateSpace. It's available on Amazon.com and Barnes & Noble and on Kindle and Nook. And that was in 2010. And then this February, I published my second novel, In the War Zone, which you've mentioned in your introduction, and am busy promoting it and working on some other projects which you're aware of. That's the nutshell end of it.
Well, I read APO 123. The APO 123 is so good that it's 600 pages, and I read it in one day. All right, so that just tells
you're
you.
You're kidding. Well, you must be. You took that speed reading course I've read about and heard about, because I'm telling you you're better at this than almost anybody I've ever heard of, being able to go through that book in that many pages in a day. My God.
Well,
anyway,
I read it and the print was large enough, so I was just like, okay, this is interesting. Besides the fact that the characters were so interesting, and I loved Anthony, and I wanted to see what other kind of trouble he was going to get into and what Barasak was going to do to him. And that was a really good. I mean, I wanted to punch him in the head too, and I was getting annoyed. But the ending sort of was, you know, just desserts. It was really good. But let's talk about my guy from the War Zone. I really love this
sure.
book, and I remember when you read my review. My review was a little bit different than what you thought it was going to be. I just sort of took it a little step further. I know that he came from a bad neighborhood and he lived in a trailer park, and he lived in a bad, you know, in the black ghetto. So that was more what you thought of that as a war zone. I grew up in the South Bronx, so you might say the same thing. But it's
I know
of
the
like,
South Bronx, yes.
Yes, I grew up on Southern Boulevard in Tremont, and, you know, it makes you tough, but it was okay. And you learn to you know, get around and deal with all this other stuff. But each of the characters in the book had their own private war. That's how I wrote the review, so I just took it a step further. Did you model the main character, Gibb Quinn? I liked him. He's really good. Did you model him after anyone in particular and tell everybody about him? Because he was really, I like this character.
Yes. The truth of the matter is that Gibb Quinn was not modeled after anybody in particular. I'm somebody who's always been a fan of reluctant heroes. And, you know, people who are courageous under fire. And, you know, as was said by Alicia Farrell, to him, moral courage is as important, I believe, as physical courage. And this is a man who had both. He's a driven individual, as we know, driven because of his, if you might say, impoverished background and his determination to prove that his mother was correct in making all the sacrifices she made for him. And so in that sense, it's an everyman's story, you know, everyman's story of people who come from difficult circumstances in this day and age, and the kind of neighborhood he came from. You've just described one, the South Bronx. There are these neighborhoods around the country. They have characters like Gibb Quinn have a lot to overcome. He also had the good fortune to be a good athlete. But for being a good athlete, he might never have made it out of that lousy neighborhood trailer park that he came from. With the aid of his high school coach, he was able to get a scholarship to a small school in Oregon and make his way out. And once he got out, he really never looked back, excepting he was hoping that he'd get a chance to take care of his mother, which of course never happened. But based on his experiences in having to fight for everything that he got, it made him a guy who was better able to cope with adversity, and he'd seen his share of it, and it helped him in his business life, and he became a super salesman. Well, then the story goes on.
Yeah, he is definitely, and he's his mother. I have to tell you, I loved his mother a little bit that you told about her, because she did it by herself and she refused to accept any kind of financial help. She is seriously my kind of person. What can I tell you? She just wanted to make sure that she did it on her own and didn't want to owe anybody anything. And you have to give somebody credit like that, because they're very few people out there that would go that far. And I think that's probably
you're correct about that. And you know, bear in mind that in certain segments of society, even today, I believe it is the case, as was in the story, which is contemporary, that people who are forced to accept charity are oftentimes looked down upon. Either that or, and his mother was determined that he was never going to be considered a charity case if she had anything to do about it. And so, therefore, she refused to accept any assistance, worked two jobs, and managed to, you know, put her boy through school.
But he appreciated everything that she did, and yet he was still up against a lot of prejudice. So he went to work for the Big Bite company, and he became the position of manager there. And he came from Las Vegas. So that was like a stigma, wasn't it?
The well, fact that he you came, know...
Why did they feel that way about him? That bothered me.
You know, I've lived in Las Vegas for a number of years.
Mm-hmm.
And it's very interesting in a way, and mm-hmm. sometimes insulting, the attitudes that
yeah.
people you meet around the country, and I do my fair share and have always done my fair share of traveling. And I can't tell you, believe it or not, how many people have asked me whether anybody actually lives in Las Vegas. I mean, for God's
really?
Sakes, they were saying that when we had 120,000 people in this town. And they're still saying it, some people that I meet, when we have over a million people in the town. And you know what I used to tell them? I used to say, actually, they're bussed in order to, you know, shorten the conversation. But that attitude translated to, or transfer that attitude over to a provincial New England town, the town of Chatham, Connecticut, where Gibb Lands, never having been anywhere in the East outside of, you know, he went to school in Nevada and then college in Oregon and worked in Seattle and had no experience whatsoever with anybody from the East, excepting for his college roommate who happened to have gone to prep school in the East. And all he knew about that was what he'd heard from his college roommate about his college roommate's experience in the East. So he lands in Chatham, Connecticut, the small coastal town, which gives provincialism, I mean, a new meaning. And the people there have the same attitude towards somebody from Las Vegas, especially someone who happens to be as a salesman, as a hustler, somebody to watch out for.
Well, I really liked him, and he had a patron that protected him. From the top. Yet his regional manager, when he came in, he went over the books and he met Ginny. We'll have to talk about her. She was a really cool character too, Jerry, I mean. And he has all this protection. Yet the regional manager, when he decides to break the rules in the manual and go outside of his district in order to create sales, why does the regional manager go after him? What's his problem?
Well, the regional manager is a bow-tied, button-down, Ivy League snit.
Yeah, sure.
And besides that part of his personality, he is somebody who is a slave to the company manual. You know, that expression we used to say that he goes by the book.
Yeah,
and one of the major tenets of the manual is, you know, thou shalt not make sales outside of your territory as a salesman. The problem is that in the town of Chatham and its surroundings, and with the resistance Gibb is meeting in the beginning there, he realizes that he, in order to make his quotas, he has to go outside of his territory, and therefore he knows that he's going to run head-on into the regional manager as a result. However, he has a choice between making his sales a quota and violating the manual or not, and having his career suffer. Now, it's also instructive to remember that the general manager, who's his patron back in Seattle, has secretly sent him to this small town and this failing store because the salesmen in Connecticut out of the regional office are not making their quotas in Connecticut. And he, if you pardon the expression, the general manager is looking for a way to goose them into action.
Mm-hmm.
And he feels that, so therefore he's willing to tolerate Gibb going outside of his territory because he knows that that will generate, you know, some interest in, and mm-hmm. hopefully motivate these guys to do better.
You know, he comes up against...
But that being said, it doesn't sit well with the regional manager.
No, nothing fit well with the regional manager. But who is Jerry and who is Sally? Sally, I felt so bad for her, but yet she really did it to herself. So
well, Jerry is a third generation native of Chatham, and as such, she is well connected in the town. But the fact of the matter is, Jerry's a lot more interested in her charitable activities than she is in business. But because she's well connected in the town, and because she wants to make sure that they don't close the store, which is in danger of being closed if Gibb is not successful, she's instrumental in helping in introducing Gibb around town. And in effect, protecting him or fending off the rumors that get started against him. Now, in the case of Sally Kilgore,
yeah.
Sally is a cocktail waitress working at where the center of activity of the townspeople is after hours in the Chatham Beach Hotel. But she happens to be from the city of Bridgeport, Connecticut. And anybody who's familiar with Bridgeport, Connecticut, especially the tougher parts of it, knows that it's as rundown a place as anybody ever came from. And Sally comes from a big family, she doesn't come from a big family. That's another one of the characters. Sally comes from a family where her father ran off with a waitress, and her mother is a drunk, and she lives in a three-decker in this slum in Bridgeport, and spends all of the time when she's with her daughter running her daughter down, and treating her daughter as if she's a slut. And so Sally, who's good-looking and smart enough, and has extremely low self-esteem. And therefore, as I think if I were characterizing it, I would say she has that, of her you would say that her idea was to live fast, die young, and make a beautiful corpse. And so she is one that with this low self-esteem engages in the end in very self-destructive conduct.
It's almost as if, you know, as an educator, I know that you get difficult children. It's almost as if she's living down to what everybody expects her to be. Every time Gibb tells her or, you know, Jerry tells her, you can be better, you can uplift yourself, she doesn't want to hear it. It's almost as if in her mind that's all she can do. Is that it? That's the case with her.
Well, yes, yeah, that's the correct analysis. And remembering that's the way her mother treats her.
Yeah,
you know, and there isn't anything that she can do to convince her mother otherwise. When you don't have a father, when your father ran off with a waitress, and really don't want to run down waitresses, and you're left with an alcoholic mother, I guess if I was going to compare it, just compare the attitudes of Gibb's mother to Sally's mother.
Yeah, that
would
be really
have the two ends
dire
of the
contrast.
The spectrum.
Can you have a question?
Yeah, I'm kind of fascinated that you seem to have some very strong feelings about the places that people come from. And I was wondering if you generally, I mean, is that just how you characterizing these characters, or is there something about the way that you see kind of connections with geography and personality in general? And I'm asking that, by the way, as a New Englander.
Well, yeah, I mean, I grew up in Brookline, Massachusetts,
okay,
which is then you know where it is. It's right outside of Boston. But, you know, I had plenty of exposure to the slums of Boston growing up, too, and elsewhere. And the attitudes of people, you know, from the wrong side of the tracks, and also the way people from the wrong side of the tracks were generally growing up, at least in my case, treated by others and looked down upon. And, you know, they always had that, the expression of the people that were the most admired, and you as a New Englander will know this expression, they would say, he or she made it out. and the goal was to make it out make it out in the sense of a writer, I guess, is a frame of mind or a state of mind. But in reality, with the underprivileged and the rough parts of town, I characterize it as a war zone. Making it out of the war zone, there aren't, I think really if you were to take a poll, you'd find out that there were not that many people that do make it out. But in my experience, the ones who made it out were much admired by the people who didn't make it out, those who bothered to keep in touch with, you know, where they came from.
So tell everybody about Alicia Farrell, because there's a lot going on. When he decides to become close to Alicia, or she sort of goes, and the people of the town ostracize him even further. So the prejudice really rings true, not even just because he comes from Las Vegas, and not because they look at Sally, they look down on her, but then she's got a whole group of people, other men that she's with too. Who is Alicia Farrell, and how does she come into this with Gibb?
Well, Alicia Farrell is the daughter of one of the two ruling families in the town. And so they are considered as royalty, as so often happens in towns small and large. And people in the town of Chatham, generally speaking, kiss their rings. It's sort of accidental in a way. Here, there's Jerry Morgan, who's a third generation Chathamite. Okay, and when the Farrells, when Alicia and her mother show up at the Big Bite store to buy a PC for Judge Farrell, who's the father and the patriarch of the family, Jerry Morgan immediately sees this is an opportunity. Gibb hasn't made many inroads in the town or the county, being from Las Vegas. And Jerry sees this as his opportunity. If he can satisfy her mother, Alicia's mother, Mrs. Farrell, that Alicia's mother will reward him by blessing him in the town. And that's exactly what happens. And so his getting close to Alicia, as you know, is just accidental. The free lessons come with the sale of the PC.
Yeah.
The judge elects not to take the free lessons. He's too busy or doesn't care, and tells his daughter to take them. And when Alicia comes to the store to take lessons because she's working as a paralegal in her uncle's law firm. And can use the software education. It starts out, of course, as simply as Gibb keeps trying to tell the people in the town. All it is him satisfying a customer.
Yes.
But the townspeople, seeing her show up there once a week and knowing that she's engaged to the son of the other ruling family. In the beginning, not engaged, but you might as well say she was engaged and winds up engaged to him. The townspeople then become very suspicious, and they're not about to have a Vegas hustler steal away the town belle, who's royalty. And therein lies the tale.
Yeah, it is. It gets more complicated, but we're not going to tell everybody that. So his store becomes one of the best, right? And then he becomes...
That's right. He becomes number one in square foot sales in New England, which is something, remember, that he has accomplished before. He's the super salesman.
He is a super salesman, but, you know, it's sort of not appreciated here. So when we get to meet Sally a little bit more, because I don't want to tell everybody too much about it, she's determined to destroy herself, and she becomes close with Gibb too, right? She reforms a relationship, but in such a way that she really doesn't see that it could be something good, correct?
Well, that's correct. Well, Gibb, you know, in the beginning, Gibb is looking for some social life.
Yes.
And because he works so many hours a day and night and weekends, he doesn't have really a lot of time to look around. Not that he would be able to look around much in the town of Chatham, given how people regarded him, as suspicious as people regarded him. But there is Sally, good-looking, and Gibb and the others around town, around the Main Street businesses, hang out at the bar at the off-season at the hotel, and there's Sally. And so Sally becomes the target of opportunity. Now, he is, I must say in the beginning, of course, he's neutral on Sally in that regard. Sally, this lack of self-esteem, Sally, you know, I think she regards herself, I know, as a sex object. In the end of this relationship of theirs, and that's because, as you say, because of her low self-esteem and her determination to flame out, I guess you might say, you know, that she'd never be good enough for Gibb. Let's put it that way, which in a way is ironic, right? Given Gibb's background,
that's true. But she doesn't. I get the feeling that she doesn't feel that she's good enough for just about anybody except for the one person, this Mike, that she seems to get close to, and he's really not good enough for her, in a sense.
Well, you're right about that. You're right about that, anyway.
Yeah.
Our biker friend, yeah.
Our biker friend,
but
yeah.
That's true. Yeah.
I sort of looked into this, and as I said, when I wrote the review, I think John was surprised. I knew what the war zone meant, and when he asked me to read it, I said, yeah, this is going to be really interesting. But it just seems that Gibb and Sally and even Jerry, all of them seem to be fighting a war of their own in a different
way.
Well,
we came out, I want to remind you that we came out in the same place.
Oh, okay, I just want to make sure.
We came out in the same place with regard to the war zone. The war zone, you know, it's a euphemism, you know.
Yeah.
You know, for tough times and tough places, and it's a state of mind. In the end, it's a state of mind. You know,
I mean,
especially if you're stuck in it.
Well, don't I know? You know, it's funny. As an educator, you get students that, you know, come from tough areas, and I taught in a tough area for all my life. And the one thing I tried to explain to them is that you can get out, you can be anything that you want. And they've turned out some really great kids and some really great students, and they've really succeeded. Because if they hear what you're saying, and you say, well, it doesn't matter where you live, it's what you want to do with your life. And they have to have the courage to just want to do well. And a lot of them do, and a lot of them don't. And I think what's gratifying is that when they Facebook me and tell me that they love me and that they're doing so well, and they do. There's a whole bunch of them on there. There's a site from my school. And it's great because you can get out of the war zone. You just have to want to. It doesn't mean that it's going to be easy. You just have to work really hard at it. But what makes Gibb so determined to help Sally? Why does he even care? Because she's so self-destructive, it's really scary. But what makes him want to help her? And what causes the town to just sort of, from number one, he goes down quite a bit. How come?
Well, you know, in the first place, Sally, you know, Gibb looks at Sally, And she reminds him of his high school girlfriend, who came from a tough, you know, the same gangbanger neighborhood, and who was faced with the same upbringing as Sally. And yet, despite all of that, his high school girlfriend managed to make it out of the war zone and have a decent life. make it up into the middle class just by hard work in the hotel system there in Las Vegas. And Gib looks at Sally and says she's good looking, she's smart, she can do the same. But the forces of self-destruction are just, in Sally's case, they're just too strong. Because now, in the case of Gib's high school girlfriend, she had a determination and sense of worth, and she could make it out, that she was determined to get out herself. And isn't self-help the first thing, you know, without that, right? Without that recognition, you're never going to get there. And in Sally's case, she just couldn't cross that divide. Either she'd been at it too long, or there was also this rage to live that she had, you know, to live the fast life.
Yeah.
So there's some of that too. But I think you're right. Basically, it's the lack of self-esteem that did her in.
Yeah, she sort of had a self-destructive attitude, and no matter what happens and no matter how far down she goes, she just doesn't seem to understand that she can get up. And even Jerry, too, in her own way, you know, needed a boost from him, too. He was a good friend to everybody. So if you could sum him up in just five words, Gib, what kind of a person? I mean, he's determined, he's kind. So I can't see why they didn't like him. Just because he came from someplace different doesn't, you know, that the prejudice reigns through. I mean, and...
I must say that, you know, we're talking about fiction here, but in fiction and real life intersect.
Yeah.
You know, they intersect. And in small towns, oftentimes, you know, you find that people have real difficulty with accepting outsiders. I'm telling you from my experience, when it comes to somebody from Las Vegas, it's easy to see. You know, the people have such they have fixed in their mind a vision of Las Vegas as a town. You know, what stays in Vegas, what plays in Vegas, stays in Vegas.
Stays in Vegas, yeah.
And all those things that the hotels have spent millions of dollars to promote, you know, if you want to play, come here, and all that sort of stuff, people in small towns, in this particular small town, I think would be typical of a lot of places, would just look askance at someone from there, and as I say, especially a salesman with a salesman's attitude, that's bad enough. But I think if we hadn't had the rest of the story, Gib could have overcome it, because he didn't care about. Remember, his interest in life is staying number one on the leaderboard.
Yeah, I know.
Not in making friends.
No, he didn't care about. So, I know that.
So he could have made it out of there if he didn't get tagged with this with what the townspeople decided was his desire to steal away the town belle, you know, a member of the royal family. However, I mean, you know, in the end, it's a question of, you know, who's doing the stealing? You know, who is it? Her? Is it him? You know, but the townspeople don't care, because they don't want her to do it either. You know what I mean? They want royalty to marry royalty. Let's put it that way, okay?
It's almost as if she's supposed to be programmed to do whatever they tell her to do. It's their own little sort of fixed behavior. It's almost as I was waiting for them to put a chart on the town when you come in here. These are the ways you're supposed. These are the rules for this town, and if you break them, you have to leave. I was waiting for them to have some kind of behavior chart there, because that's what it almost sounds like. And you know, they're so stringent, these little towns. It's like if you don't wear the right things, or if you're not from the right family. I imagine they're the same way with religious groups too. If they don't belong to the right religious group that they belong to, then they ostracize you too. In this particular case.
Narrow-mindedness is narrow-mindedness.
Yeah.
And, you know, do you remember Princess Margaret and some of the things she went through?
Yes.
You know, when she had an eye for those who weren't royalty, you know. Anyway.
It's a sad world that everybody just can't just treat people for who they are and what they are. It's really sad.
Yeah, but I want to remind you that this is exactly why, in story and song, many people try to escape from small towns.
I can imagine that's the reason, because they don't want to deal with such narrow-mindedness, and kids shouldn't.
Yeah.
And then the kids are taught the same way in these towns, right? They're taught the same way.
Oh, yeah.
That's scary. I wonder what would happen. We were just talking to Mark Boughton about his book about cults. I wonder what would happen if a cult came into one of these towns and tried to take over.
Are you kidding me? Yeah,
might be good for the next
question
novel.
Would be do they have a gun store in town? That would be the question.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. Guns and weapons, that's what scares me. And then these kids are so held back, some of them, that I wonder sometimes if that wouldn't happen in these small towns. It happens everywhere anyway. Anyway, why is Gibb such a good friend to Tom, and why is he such a real – he's his real friend, isn't he?
Well, Tom Perkins' college roommate, remember, is the one that showed that showed Gibb the other side of life. I mean, he came from a wealthy family, was a prep school guy, New England prep school, not a good student. They had a mutual interest in Gibb having Tom socialize him and Tom getting through school. With Gibb's help, Gibb being a great student, as it turned out. But more importantly, Tom had experience, having gone to Exeter Academy, he had experience with the New England attitudes of the type that we're talking about and people, and he was worried about someone with Gibb's background and knowing Gibb as he did. About how he was going to fare among, with his Eastern small town culture that Gibb had no idea what he was getting himself into. And so his friend, seeing the difficulties that Gibb was experiencing, was giving Gibb the advice that, people in Seattle are a lot more forgiving and a lot more tolerant than people in the town of Chatham and its surroundings, and that in Seattle they cared about what you accomplished more than what family you were born into, and trying to keep Gibb on an even keel, and also keeping Gibb from losing his self-confidence over this, as a good friend explaining to Gibb that it wasn't Gibb, that was at fault here. It wasn't shortcomings on Gibb's part that caused the town to turn against him.
It was the town itself. But I wonder if partially it's because of the way the town is. Is that why Sally is the way she is, and Jerry just sort of left herself in the same kind of position, at the store, and that most of the other characters seem the same way. They just didn't seem that they can get any farther than they could get in any position, and he was the only one. And it's right, it wasn't him that caused the problem. It was the narrow-mindedness of the town, because she said anyplace else he would have been successful, even though he went out of his region, it wouldn't have mattered. So I wonder what would have happened if you put Sally or Jerry in another town, if they would have been the same.
Well, remember what Art Donovan told Gibb. Those who got up and went to college, and had other ideas, they left.
some people in that particular town had no ideas.
And the ones that remained were ones that liked it just the way it was. Maybe because they felt secure in that atmosphere.
Maybe they're just afraid of change.
Yeah, put a wall around the world.
Yeah. Well, maybe sometimes they're just afraid of change, or they're afraid to question, or they're afraid to break the mold.
Well, in medieval times, Fran, they had moats.
Yeah. Yeah, I know.
But, they didn't have a moat in Chatham.
Maybe they need one.
But it wouldn't have been surprised me if they started to dig one.
I wouldn't be surprised if they did a barrier and put a wall around the fence so no one could get in.
After they got a load of gib.
I know. I wonder if what would happen if they got a second gib. So are you going to do a sequel to this book? Because, you know, you ended it, but I'm not going to tell anybody how. The ending was good.
Well,
that was a surprise ending. That was really good, and you left room to write another one. Are you going to bring him back? Well, what's next? Besides, we have a few minutes to talk about the other book, because if I read it in one day, definitely everybody has to know about it.
Well, I think that you can look. All I'm going to say is that I think you can look forward to a sequel.
Oh, okay. That's good. That is very good.
I'm not advertising that. Or now I am, of course, but I have not been advertising.
We have a lot of people
that.
Listening out there. I hope you guys heard me. And those of you that want to read The War Zone, you should really pick up a copy of The War Zone, because it's great. I think, you know, I'm surprised that it's one of those books that I think even young adults could read, because it really is not that graphic. And I really think that people in small towns and people, maybe even college groups, could talk about prejudice and self-esteem. This would be great for a discussion group, this book, also. As an educator, that's just the educated part of me, looking at it as taking it further than what it is. So tell everybody about, and you're writing the sequel now, so we're not going to ask you when, do you have any idea when it's going to come out, when you're going to be done?
Well, if all goes well, and depending, because as you know, I'm at work, trying to turn my first novel into a TV series, but I'm hoping by next fall, because I really have to do some research that I don't have time to do right now in order to do justice to the sequel. So.
Well, I just want you to know, when Warzone and APO 1, 2, 3 come out as movies, you have to have the premiere in New York, because I want to sit in the front row.
Do you want to hear a story about In the War Zone and Dirty Harry?
Go on. Yes. I remember what you said in your email. That's why I brought it up. I forget. My husband can't stand it. I forget nothing. He goes crazy, because I can tell you what he ate for lunch 15 and a half years ago. So, yeah, go ahead.
My wife and I were having dinner with a business associate of mine in L.A. who's pretty well connected. Last year, and it was like last November, almost a year ago or so, and I had in mind that Clint Eastwood would have been at his age, I didn't see that there are all that many roles for a guy his age, but I thought that Art Donovan, the cab driver in the War Zone, would have been a role that would really appeal to him. But I had no way, of course, of reaching him. And then I'm having dinner, my wife and I, with this, as I say, business associate. And I just offhandedly said to him, do you know anybody that knows Clint Eastwood? And without hesitating, he said to me, yeah, I do. And I said, well, who would that be? He said, me. He said, my secretary of many years quit and went to work as Clint Eastwood's secretary. And why do you ask? And I said, well, I've got this book of mine, and I'd like to sell the movie rights to Clint Eastwood, and I'd like to pitch him on it. So anyway, the long and short of it is that I got the materials together and a synopsis, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And got the package directly to Clint Eastwood, and was told that, and this is months later, of course, that Clint Eastwood had turned it down, and his secretary said it was because he really wasn't planning to make, that he was making the movie that's just out now of his, and shooting it in Atlanta, and his secretary said he had one more movie and he wasn't going to be directing any more movies or producing any more movies. Whether or not that's true, I don't know, but that was the story that was told to me. At any rate, so from there, the way I got to I got APO 123 to be looked at as a TV series was. I spoke to another LA friend of mine, told him that I'd struck out with Clint Eastwood, and asked him if he knew anybody that knew Mark Wahlberg. Now, I think if those of you who know who Mark is and anything about his background, but he had a very similar background to Gib Quinn growing up in Dorchester, Massachusetts. So anyway, I was looking for somebody that might introduce me to Mark Wahlberg or his production company. And so I got introduced to this TV syndicator with about 30 years experience from L.A., and met him at the National Association of Broadcasters show in April here in Las Vegas. And I brought my copy of In the War Zone, and I was pitching him on getting an introduction to Mark Wahlberg, and he had absolutely, as it turned out, zero interest in Mark Wahlberg or connecting me up with him, although he did know him. And then went on to tell me that what he was looking for was content that was suitable for producing a TV series. And then, of all things, said, and in particular, material that can be shot in France. I almost fell off the chair. And I said, are you kidding me?
That fits.
I said, you're kidding me. He said, no. I said, well, my first novel, it takes place in France, the whole thing. And from there, anyway, I agreed to send him a copy of it and a synopsis and so forth, and which I did. And after a couple of months, his people had looked at all the material and came back and told me that they had concluded that it was suitable for a 10 or 12 week 1 hour series. Mm-hmm. And so I had the validation, and that was recently, you know, that it can be made into a TV show, and I'm on the trail of that right now.
Well, I hope you do, because, you know, that would be great. And then I could say I reviewed the book and spoke to the author and, you know, whatever. The only problem
you'll get a seat in the front row. You do know that your audience doesn't know.
You better believe I'm going to come to the seat in the front row, definitely, and because I could say I read the book. The book is fantastic. We have about 10 minutes, so I just want to announce my next show before I conclude and ask a few more questions. On December 6th, we're doing a show dedicated to veterans, because December 7th, but we're doing it on the 6th. I'm going to be interviewing Kenneth Eaton, Missing Dog Tags. He's a prisoner of war from the Korean War. Should be interesting. And Rebecca Coleman wrote Heaven Shall Fall, and it deals with a young man that came back from Afghanistan and Iraq and with post-traumatic stress disorder. Should be interesting. On the 18th, as I said before, we're going to have Ken's going to be on the show, and John Betcher and Karen Vaughan and Mark Boughton and a whole bunch more people for Mystery Tuesday. And we're going to talk about marketing. We're going to talk about writing a mystery, carving one particular character, a whole bunch of stuff. And I have a mystery author, and I'm not telling you who that is. And on January 10th, Cheryl Bradshaw and Lisa Bennett, and her book is Eco-Literate. It's interesting about the ecology and about the environment. And on January 16th, David Darricott, Internal Security, he's going to be on the show. Also on the 18th, and on the 24th, best-selling author Alan Topol, The Spanish Revenge, if you really want to read something great. And on the 31st, our very, very own Delaney Oakes is going to talk about her new release. So that's what's coming up so far. And, of course, there's more in February 14th, Sandra Brown. And you never know who else is going to come up in between there. So tell everybody, John, where they can get your books. Wait a minute.
Well, APO 123 and In the War Zone are available on Amazon. And they're also available on Kindle. APO 123 is available on Kindle and Nook. The reason why In the War Zone isn't available on Nook yet is because they have a program, Kindle Direct, at Amazon, that you if you give them the first 90 days of your book, the rights to it exclusively, then they have a lending program for people that supposedly promotes sales. So I'm in that, and when that 90 days expires, I will then have it on the Nook. In the meantime, for reviewers, I have it available in PDF by the end of this week, plus Kindle mobile, and also EPUB.
You have to put that on my site for reviewing your book. You can ask any one of the 20 reviewers on the site to review the book too.
Can I? Okay.
Yes,
well, I'll do that.
Yeah, there's a whole bunch of people. But before I forget, Ken has a short story about Vietnam and post-traumatic stress disorder in Empirical coming out in January. So, Ken, the show on the 6th, are you going to be there so you can tell everybody about it while we're talking about to Rebecca Coleman?
The show on the 6th of January?
No, December.
I am planning to be. Huh?
That's good.
Oh,
so we can talk about your short story, too, if you give it to me to read.
Oh, I will. I can email it to you.
I can put, if you don't mind if I print it out when I can, I can.
Not
enough.
Of course, I'll send it to you.
You could email it to me, and I could just add it to the top of my 21 books that are staring at me, waiting for me to read them. Yeah, I had a little bit of a shock the other day. All the books that didn't come during the storm showed up on Monday and Tuesday. And I just stared at them, and I go, oh, my God. And I read, like, 3 yesterday and 2 today because I wanted to rest my eyes for the show. And I've got, like, 4 staring at me right now, and that's not going to happen. Maybe one more. And I was totally honored because James Patterson's publicist sent me 5 books to review. And I read one, but the other 4 are going to have to wait because there are other people whose books are equally as good that I want to read first, too. And which is great. So you did 21 people, but I will read the short story first, if you don't mind that I print it out. That's great. It should be really interesting. And, John, as soon as the next one comes out, you have to tell me. And if you
hey, post you'll it, be the – I mean this sincerely. You'll be the first to know. The first.
Oh, thank you. The first one. I think I surprised myself when I read APO 1 through 3, and I go, okay, I got that right, too. I've had some tough books this particular month, but that's okay because that's how I learned, and I've learned an awful lot, and I've read an awful lot of great books. And one of the books that I read was by an Egyptian author, Alhamad Hamin Sykes, and my husband just read it, and he couldn't put it down. And he's getting APO 1, 2, 3 next. Yes, he wants to read that also. He doesn't read everything that I get, but when it's about the military or something like that, he's probably going to read your book also. I can guarantee it, and he'll definitely give me some feedback on it too. So I would like to thank everyone. Oh, good, I have that. I'm going to print that out in 5 minutes. I have Ken's short story. I can't wait to read that. And by the way, everybody, Bertha and Tilly, Sisters Forever. I came up with my own title because no one came to help me. My 10th book is going to come out probably in December. As soon as I read it in correct, just to make sure that I don't need to do any more editing because my editor went through it 5 times. So Bertha and Tilly, Sisters Forever is coming out next month, and it's dedicated to the memory of my sister that died last year, and it's how I keep her alive, the true stories of our antics. And Bertha and Tilly Forever and all my other 9 titles are on Barnes & Noble and Amazon and anywhere else that you want to buy something. And I had the greatest honor the other day. I gave my Bertha and Tilly Forever to a lady that works in urgent care. And her daughter read it, and she's a teen, and they fell in love with Bertha and Tilly, but the book was great, and her teacher loved it. So I think that's the greatest testament that you can get when kids love your book, because it's meant for YAs. And Ken, right before we go, do you want to add anything or anything about your marketing group or anything? Or we're going to talk about that in December.
We're going to talk about it in December, but if people want to contact me,
yeah,
who are often looking for a great way to market, I hope they will do so, and they can look for me on Facebook, and I'll be glad to respond to them.
Yeah, this is a great marketing group, let me tell you.
Yeah, the neatest thing about it is all these people who are coming up with all these wonderful new and better ways to help everybody. I love it.
Yeah, I'm just trying to figure out. I know I have a board on Pinterest, and anybody else that belongs to the group has a board on Pinterest. I add stuff and stuff like that, but I wasn't sure if I was getting it in the right place. I haven't figured out which is the seasonal board. I guess I'm going to have to email Linda and find out if I can get accepted to the seasonal board also. But meanwhile, I've added other stuff to it. It's great. It's a great group, and like I said at the beginning of the show, Amazon sent me an email, do I want to read a good mystery? And it was my book, Faces Behind the Stones, and the other one,
You're
Bad
kidding.
Choices. No, I almost fell off my chair.
Congratulations. There are a lot of falling off the chairs on this program.
Yeah, I tell you, I couldn't believe it. Now, people who just buy the book, they're books for YAs, for kids that make mistakes, and you know, don't want to wind up behind one of my gravestones. But I am, if I ever get done with the 21 books I have to review, I will be writing, the title is Lies Beneath the Stones. There, I said it. That's the title of my new book. And if I could ever get 10 minutes, it's half written. I just have to finish it and get time to do it. So I want to thank you, John, so very much. And I want to thank you, Ken and Sandra. And we will be back December 6th with a show dedicated to our veterans. And I'm going to print out Ken's story so that I can add that to my list. And we'll have just three people. And on that note, I want to thank everyone. And we'll be back on December 6th. And good night. Thank you so much, John. I appreciate it.
I just want to leave everybody with the pitch that APO 123 is a MASH for lawyers. MASH after the TV series.
And you have to read it because I loved it. And if you didn't read my review on reviewing your book, read it because you're going to want to read the book. And if you're a reviewer and want to read the book, email me or just put a message on that Facebook site and we will get you in touch with John. And let me just tell you, the only stipulation for posting a review on my site is has to be positive. No negative reviews and no negative comments. That's just me. Because there's so much negativity in the world, it's not going to be on my site. I just don't like it. So if you don't like a book or you review a book and you really find that it's not what you want to do, you can post it anywhere else, or you can post a summary like I do. If I get a book I don't like, which is rare, I just write a summary. I will not post anything negative. It's just me. I'll give you an honest review maybe, on the side, but I won't write anything nasty. Because what I don't like, someone else might. So on that note, I am going to say goodnight, and thank you so much, Don. Thank you, Ken. Thank you, Sandra.
You're welcome, and thank you for inviting me.
You're welcome, and I will back again on December 6th. Good night.
Wow.